Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. As a junior monk, I used to have fantasies about giving really good Dhamma talks, and now that I'm asked to give them, I always feel nervous before. I was thinking about a sutta today that reminds us that we're all, everybody here, and all human beings really, we're all brothers and sisters and birth, aging, sickness, and death, regardless of age and regardless of nationality, skin color, race, regardless of what we believe or what religion we are, regardless of our views and opinions, we're all brothers and sisters in birth, aging, sickness, and death. We all share that in common. And so we all have that same final destination, that same fate, that death is an absolute certainty for all of us, and it's just looming over everybody, over all of our heads. When it's going to happen is a complete uncertainty, but it is absolutely certain that it will happen at some point. And so it's like the sutta where the Buddha's speaking with King Pasenadi and using the simile of four mountains coming in towards all of us, that death is coming in from all sides, looming over us. And so the Buddha asks, What are you going to do, great king? Now, if death is looming over you, it's an absolute certainty. And then King Pasenadi replies, what else is there to do but to live righteously? And to live according to the Dhamma, and to live a good life, and to live with the Dhamma as our refuge, making ourselves our refuge. And so that's really it. How do we relate to death, and how do we react when we have the true knowledge that it's an absolute certainty that death is going to happen to all of us at some point in time? Might be soon, it might be far off in the future. Really, this life isn't that long. Young people die, old people die, babies. Doesn't really matter what age you are. And so we live with the precepts and our practices, and live as good a life as possible so that hopefully when the time of death comes, we don't have any regrets and we can reflect on our life and say that we lived a good life. Because really, no matter how much we cling to this life, and no matter how much our relatives or, say, our parents hope that, things take a natural order or a natural succession. Hopefully, the children pass away after the parents, not before. But it just doesn't always happen that way. So, no matter how much the parents cling to their children, the children can still pass away, sometimes in tragedies, diseases. The Buddha said the causes of death are many, the causes of life are few. So, hopefully, when the time of death comes, or when it, then we can reflect on our life and say we lived a good life and we did the absolute best that we could. And so, particularly with the training that we're taking on here at the monastery, we're taking on precepts and practicing meditation, generosity, patience, patient endurance, renunciation. And so, with that acknowledgement that death is looming over us, then just really trying to develop our life in the most skillful way possible, the best way possible, so that even if in the past, before we picked up the practices of goodness, before we pick up the precepts, before we acknowledge and turn towards the Dhamma, so even if there's regrets from those times, hopefully we can get to a point where we can say, well, those regrets have been left far behind me, and now I can say I can die without regrets. And that's extremely good for us, and also extremely good for others. Say, for myself, one of my greatest fears of death is just how my parents would react. But I feel that if I would be able to tell them that I've been happy the way that I've lived, then that would ease their pain somewhat, I would think. Or if they can feel that their child is passing on to a good destination with some conviction that... being devoted to the good, being devoted to sila, being devoted to internal development in what's skillful, what's wholesome. It just has really good benefits for ourselves and for others. And so within this time interval, which is our life, it's important to take on whatever we do in our life and really try to do it well and do it with mindfulness. Because, say, particularly here at the monastery, we're living in a very ordinary way, but we're also cultivating mindfulness in everything we do, trying to take sati sampajanya, applying it to our life. And so doing things well is going to be of great benefit. And whatever we're doing, you can take anything as an example. Take bowing, for instance. So when you come into the meditation hall, instead of just coming in and automatically bowing just because everybody else is doing it or just because that's the rule, then really taking a moment and kneeling on your haunches. Usually the men will be on their toes. Usually women will be with their feet tucked under them. And just putting the hands in Anjali together at the heart. And just, there's a number of things you can do at that point. You can take just a mindful breath, just one mindful breath, just attempting to be free, have a mind free of defilement just for that moment. It can just be 1 or 2 seconds, but just being mindful just in that moment. Or you can make a determination. You can say in your mind, say to yourself, may all beings be free, may all beings be happy, or may I attain liberation at some point. By the merit of this bowing, may I attain liberation. So you can make an internal determination before bowing. And then once you've established mindfulness in that moment, then you can bow. Doing it well, touching the head to the ground, not raising your rear end up in the air, but just and slowly, but not too slowly, but just mindfully bowing with the elbows touching the knees and the hands, the forehead touching the ground in between your two hands, and then 3 bows, and doing it with just steadiness and mindfulness, and then taking up your meditation position. Or when you go to your kuti, go to your dwelling place, and go inside. And the first thing you do is bow to the shrine. And nobody's watching you do it. Nobody's going to know if you don't do it. But just seeing the benefit in it and just going into the kuti, setting our bag down, doing the same thing, establishing mindfulness, bowing, then taking our things, putting them away in an orderly fashion. At that point, we might want to clean our dwelling place, or if it's already clean, things are already in order, and taking up meditation. Or if we're going to take a rest, you know, resting for a short period of time might be after the meal. And so just bowing well, incredibly important. It's something we do here at the monastery. And when you're leaving your dwelling place, you know, steadying mindfulness again, maybe mindfulness has wandered, maybe hindrances have arisen, but just steadying the mindfulness once again, coming back to oneself, bowing, yeah, turning off the lights, leaving the dwelling place, heading down. Maybe you're heading down for tea or heading down for morning or evening puja. Or even before going to sleep, you decide you're going to go to sleep, then there might be a desire just to flop down, just to lay down. I'm really tired. It's been a long day. I've been practicing, or it's been some sort of work project. But just to then kneel in front of the shrine, establish mindfulness, and bow, determine, you know, may the merit of my life be shared out with others, with my parents and relatives, with my teachers, in the day with some sharing of merit. You can even just do it internally, incredibly wholesome, incredibly good thing to do. Nobody's going to know that you've done it, and yet you'll see the benefit over time. You know, cleaning things, that's something we do in the monastery. So just when we clean something, we have a morning chore, we're cleaning something, just doing it well, doing it thoroughly. You know, recalling the story about Sariputta, Venerable Sariputta, wherever he went, he would clean things. If it was out of place, if there was a path that wasn't swept, walking meditation path wasn't swept, if he was there, he would clean it. If he didn't have a broom, he would sweep the leaves away with his foot. Or Longpu Man, the stories about Longpu Man always having his kuti in order. Wherever he was, it was clean, neat, and tidy. And so that's the way. That's the way we do it. If we're cleaning a room, it's a morning chore, instead of just going through the motions, sweeping around things, try to really make it clean. If we're in there's a room, there's chairs, you know, move the chairs aside. There's rugs, take the rugs out. There's foot mats, take the foot mats out. If there's things on the shelf, move them off, move them to another shelf, wipe down that shelf, wipe the floor down. Maybe you sweep it first and then give it a mop. And then before putting things back, then you can even take a damp rag and just go around the edges of the floor because the mop doesn't get there. And the trim collects a lot of dust. After that's done, then mindfully putting the chairs back, putting the rugs back. Maybe when you're outside, before you put the rugs back, you can shake them out or beat them out. They might be dusty. And then put them back. Once you've wiped the shelf off and it's dried a bit, you can put the things back. There might be another shelf. You can take things off of that shelf or desk. Do the same thing. You can take things out from one side of the room and move it to the other side of the room. Do that side, put things back, and then do the same at the other side. And a lot of the time, nobody's going to notice if we do that, but there can be a subconscious noticing. You know, somebody walks into that room, it's got a special quality to it. It's really well done. It's pleasing. And there's a quality of brightening the mind. There was mindfulness and self-awareness brought to that act of that simple act of cleaning. That's just incredibly good, incredibly wholesome. Or sweeping or raking the paths. Just doing it well. If you're going to take a rake, then yeah, raking the path in a way that doesn't overdo it, doesn't destroy the path, but it gets the leaves off the path. Or if we're sweeping, just not just doing it as quickly as possible, but taking time, making a meditation out of it. You can even be reciting Buddho or just focusing on the feelings in the body while you're doing that sweeping or raking. And then it benefits others. So it's pleasing to walk up the path. Or the chanting. Just doing the chanting well and reflecting on it while we're doing it. And these are all just very ordinary things. And yet the chanting, there's real power in it if it's done well, done with mindfulness. And say if you just reflect on the chanting we did tonight, just the very basic homage to Buddha Dhamma Sangha and praises to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And so we chant it, and sometimes the mind can wander, thinking about a work project or there's some sort of fantasy or a hindrance is coming up, or maybe we're very tired. But just reflecting on what we're actually saying, there is power to that. To the Dhamma I dedicate this body and life. By the utterance of this truth, may I grow in the Master's way. So there's power to that determination that we make when we're chanting. For me, there is no other refuge. The Dhamma is my excellent refuge. And so, yeah, we chant this almost every day, morning and evening. Yeah, so just reflecting on the chanting. And, you might even have the experience of really getting into the chanting to the point where when you chant, to the Buddha, I dedicate this body and life, maybe your hair stands on end. And that's wholesome. That's faith arising. That's saddha. And that's really what's going to keep us with the practice. And sometimes it's easy to get lost thinking about the future. Like, what's my practice going to be like in the future? What am I going to be like in the future? Having been what in the past, what am I going to become in the future? When is my practice going to bear fruit? No matter how much I meditate, my mind just wanders all the time. And so in the context of this life we're living, also just keeping the perspective that everybody has their own speed at which they're going to progress in the practice and the training and the bhavana, the mental cultivation, and in the meditation. And, we might slip up. We might break precepts, monks and lay people as well might break precepts, or, our meditation might not go well. We might slip up once or twice or 100 or 1,000 times. And yet just remembering that there's still a way forward. And to not throw in the towel, not to give up. Even King Ajatasattu, the son of King Bimbisara, who committed the heinous crime of patricide, of killing his father, and then was barred from the noble path. Even for him, though, he repented later in his life, and he ended up sponsoring the first council after the Buddha's parinibbana. And so, yes, because of killing his father, he was barred from becoming a stream enterer, but it's said that because of his repentance and because of his wholesome actions after that, that after a period in, you know, after a period in suffering in hell, then he would become a Pacheka Buddha in the future. And so all of our actions, whether good or bad, stay with us. And if we really mess up bad, I mean, I don't think any of us have committed any of those five heinous crimes of killing one's mother, one's father, shedding the blood of a Buddha, killing an arhant, or creating a schism in the Sangha. But sometimes we really can torment ourselves because because of some difficult mental state that won't go away, or because of a very minor argument that we had with somebody. And so really, finding ways to let go, finding ways to continue to move forward, and to not give in to the tendency to want to give up. And just blot things out, to give up our practice of mindfulness and just go back to the perceived bliss of unmindfulness, of not keeping precepts. And it could be really difficult. It's not easy to cultivate the good, but hopefully over time we start to see the benefits and we start to see the contentment that starts to grow in the heart. And one problem with that is that contentment that grows in the heart over time within the practice, it happens so slowly that we forget that it's there. And so that makes it extra important to try to remember what was our life like before we started practicing. Was there that same level of contentment or not? Was there that same level of mindfulness and letting go or not? It's like as monks, if we've been monks for a number of years, I think it's easy to forget that base level of contentment that's created by our sila, which protects us. So making the Dhamma our refuge, making ourselves our refuge, and thinking, how can the Dhamma be our refuge and how can ourself be our refuge at the same time? Because the Buddha says that in several places. I remember in 2003, when I was one Pansa, Ajahn Bunkau, this very eccentric, very senior monk, Laozhen, disciple of Ajahn Chah, abbot of a monastery in France, he came and visited us, and he was the first one ever to stay in the Loop Trail Kuti. I don't know who's living there now, but he was the one who, first stayed there. Oh, that's Tanke Mako staying there now. And he was giving a talk one night, and he said, the thing that's so interesting about the Dhamma is that the Dhamma is alive. and we are the living Dhamma. And so I think that's how the Dhamma can be our refuge, and ourselves can be our refuge as well. Because the Dhamma is in the heart, so that's where we're going to find it. And it's not something outside of ourselves. The Dhamma, the teaching, impermanence, uncertainty. Absolutely everything in our life is impermanent and completely uncertain. Certainly our bodies and minds are impermanent, and those things, those two things aren't going to go with us at the time of death. Our karma will go with us. That's the teaching, that our karma will go with us. Our good and bad actions will supply the basis for our rebirth. But this body, you know, since birth, it's grown up, it's various organs. It might be beautiful or not so beautiful, but even if we have a beautiful body, handsome body, over time, gets old, if it doesn't die or get obliterated in some tragedy, some car accident or some other tragedy, war, famine, things that happen all the time in history, then it grows old, it's not beautiful anymore, the teeth fall out, the color fades from the complexion, strength leaves us. The spirit and the will to be active and still there, but strength's not there, energy's not there. Hair grows gray, grows white, falls out. Eyesight dims, hearing dims. That's, as young people, that's where we're heading. That's the future. That's, if we don't die before then that's what's going to happen. And the mind's not going to change so much. We're still going to have that, the same mind, same tendencies. And yet the body's growing older and older. And if we do make it to old age by some stroke of fortune, then how are we going to deal with our old age and death as younger people? It's not as if we're going to be more well prepared for it unless we've been practicing, contemplating well, unless we've been deepening our mindfulness and awareness of death. It's not as if the mind's going to be more ready for it just because we're old. So really just to collect our faculties together and prepare for that experience of death now, and just to know, just to be ready. Are we devoted to what's wholesome, what's righteous? You know, sickness. Everybody gets sick at some point. Very few people maybe would be able to say that they've never been sick. I think it's 1 in 3 people have cancer to look forward to nowadays. So really asking ourselves honestly, can we say that if I was to die right now, I've lived a good life and I accept that experience? And so this is just part and parcel of the Maranusati, just the death contemplation, just internalizing it and living with it. A very important practice. It's a protection for us. Can help us to not become overly infatuated with our bodies, or just acknowledging that no matter how much yoga, qigong, right foods, healthy foods. No matter how well we take care of our bodies, they're heading in that direction. They're heading towards aging and death. It's the most ordinary thing in the world. On a certain level, it shouldn't even be depressing because it's just an experience that everybody has to undergo. There's just no doubt about that. And so we're devoted to good and keeping precepts. We're also practicing meditation. Lungpu Kao said that he reached a certain point in his meditation where bodily pleasure even started to seem coarse to him. Or he started to just group it together in the dukkha khanda, the heap of dukkha, heap of suffering. And so that's the teaching of the Dhamma as well. Pleasure and pain are two sides of the same coin. And there's the emptiness which transcends pleasure and pain. And so that's what we're aiming for. We're aiming for a happiness which is higher than ordinary happiness, the happiness of emptiness, the brightness of emptiness, through the meditation. And so everything in our life that we do, whether bowing or cleaning, chanting, any of our contemplations that we're doing, the Maranānusati, or contemplation of the body, or even the spreading of merit, acts of generosity, everything we're doing, we're directing it in the direction of freedom from suffering, liberation. So that's just a few thoughts for this evening. Mm-hmm.